Good morning. We're going to call the Government Operations and Elections Policy Committee to order. Representative O'Driscoll, would you be willing to make a motion on the minutes from February 17th?
Mr. Chair, I'll take a pass on that duty today.
Okay, Representative.
Oh, I'm just kidding. Just see who's paying attention. Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to move the minutes from the previous meeting.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Representative O'Driscoll moves the minutes from February 17th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The minutes from February 17th are adopted. Members, just a little bit of housekeeping. In speaking with Representative Nelson's point, House File 666 should be going to State Government Finance. It is still in our committee's jurisdiction, still in our possession. It did not move on the floor. So at this time, I would like to reconsider that bill to send it to Ways and Means, or sorry, to State Government Finance. So at this time, I will make a motion to reconsider House File 666. Any discussion to that? All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, House File 666 is back in front of the committee. With that, I would like to amend the motion and make the motion that House File 666 be referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? House File 666 is referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. Thank you, members, for helping us get through that housekeeping piece. Today on our agenda, we have House File 327, and Representative Scott, who is a member of this committee, so we will welcome her and let her move her bill and begin to discuss House File 327.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'd like to move House File 327. And I'm not sure. Oh, Nick, I believe it needs to go to State Gov Finance. Members, this bill would provide for a constitutional amendment to be voted on by the people of Minnesota in 2016. As you can read, the ballot question would say, shall the Minnesota Constitution be amended so that the people are secure in electronic communications and data from unreasonable searches and seizures, as they are now likewise secure in their persons, homes, papers, and effects. As you can also read in the bill, as in current law, no warrant could be issued without probable cause, and the warrant would have to describe any electronic communications or data proposed to be assessed. This bill is a 21st century protection of our Fourth Amendment rights that are currently protect us from unreasonable search and seizure. I believe this amendment is in the spirit of the founders' intentions of the Bill of Rights of protecting citizens against government intrusion of their persons, houses, papers, and effects. In the Civil Law Data Practices Committee, we spend and will continue to spend a great deal of time trying to catch our laws up to modern technology. Also, as a part of the Data Practices Commission that met 8 times over the interim, I can tell you that most of what we covered was related to new technology that is allowing the government to collect more and more data on each of us. At some points during testimony we heard, I started to question whether we as individuals were protected at all from this massive gathering of data. I believe people have a reasonable expectation of privacy when it comes to their electronic communication and data, and I believe this bill/amendment is needed to at least protect the very private communications and data we all have on our electronic devices. Think of the conversations that you've had online. How many of us have income and other sensitive information on our computers? Banking information, household budget information, detailing where we've shopped, what charities we give to, what doctors or clinics we go to. All of this data is held by third parties. And there has been some question as to whether personal data held by third parties is really indeed our data. I believe this amendment clarifies that. There are exceptions in the Constitution, in the Fourth Amendment, to this, and those exceptions would remain. And those exceptions are if an officer is given consent to search, if the search is incident to a lawful arrest, if there is probable cause to search in exigent circumstances, and if the items are in plain view. This amendment would likely not affect the issuance of an administrative subpoena according to case law. And you should have in your packets some information from Matt Gehring, who is also here, that speaks to that issue. It came up in the Civil Law Committee, and he was kind enough to do some research on case law when it comes to administrative subpoenas. Case law in the U.S. Supreme Court, many of you may have heard of Riley v. California, and that case focused on law enforcement jurisdiction over our cell phones. This amendment language is broader than that and gives our courts parameters to work within. As lawmakers, we took an oath to protect the Constitution of the state and nation. We all want what is best in the best interest of the citizens that we represent. I believe this amendment is consistent with the intent of Article 1, Section 10 of the Minnesota Constitution, and of course the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. And I do believe that it is in the best interest of all Minnesotans. In our press conference on this amendment on Monday, we had a broad support of groups such as the ACLU, the Minnesota Tea Party Alliance, the Minnesota Liberty Caucus, Occupy, the College Republicans, and legislators from both sides of the aisle. In this often politically polarized place here in St. Paul, it is refreshing to find an issue that is so bipartisan in nature and also goes to protecting the rights of all Minnesotans. And with that, Mr. Chair, we can either take testimony. There's a couple of folks here that want to testify on this bill, or we can do questions, whichever you'd like.
Thank you, Representative Scott. Representative Nelson, you're the only member on the list. What would you prefer to do? Do you have a question at this time, or would you like to hear from testifiers?
Mr. Chair, why don't we hear the testimony, and I may have more questions after.
Excellent. Thank you, Representative Nelson. With that, I have two testifiers. Representative Scott, are they both here in support of your bill? If so, you can coordinate their testimonies. I don't know which one you'd like to bring forward first.
Mr. Ealing, come first.
Perfect. Mr. Ealing, thank you for coming today. Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself for the record and who you represent, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Matt Ealing. I'm here on my own behalf today. As an individual who's followed constitutional civil liberties issues for over two decades, both commenting on these in the press and have been involved in policy change efforts, particularly in regard to the Federal Patriot Act and its search and seizure authorities. I'm appearing here today to testify in support of HF 327. This would put a question before the voters of Minnesota as to whether to amend Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution, as has been referenced already. If adopted, the proposed amendment would secure additional protections in the arena of search and seizure. And I think this is an area of law that's endured significant strains in recent decades, as the march of technology and the development of an ever more complex society has challenged traditional constitutional values. There are many reasons to support this bill. I'm going to focus largely on why to address this as a constitutional amendment as opposed to a statutory change, and I'm happy to talk about some of the specifics underlying this as well. For background, I come from a perspective that constitutional amendments should be undertaken judiciously and infrequently. A constitution works best as a statement of broad, enduring principles. And I believe that there are three criteria that should be satisfied before we go down the road of amending the Constitution, starting with the first. And that is, as a threshold matter, a Constitution should secure rights to the people. That's the first test to see if the change you're making makes any sense. And ever since Patrick Henry and the Anti-Federalists pushed for the addition of a Bill of Rights to the federal Constitution, we've seen that America's constitutional tradition has been one of securing individual rights within constitutional documents. And over time, state constitutions have mimicked the protections we found in the Federal Bill of Rights, including Article 1 of our own Constitution. Now, under the U.S. Supreme Court's doctrine of incorporation, the protections of the Federal Bill of Rights apply to the states, including the interpretation of those rights as they're decided by the U.S. Supreme Court. And over and above the protections of the Federal Bill of Rights, state constitutions can grant additional protections to the citizens of specific states, either by interpreting the Constitution or by including different language. Now, our Article 1, Section 10 mimics the Fourth Amendment language to the word. We can change that by adding additional protections, as we're proposing to do right here with HF 327. And so I think this really meets the first critical test. This grants additional rights to the people through amending the Constitution. The second point I'd make is that a constitution should not perform the job that a statute could otherwise perform. The work of constitutional change should be deliberate and should embody broad principles over and above the detail-intensive process that goes on year to year up here. And I think this gets to the matter of why a constitutional amendment is an appropriate solution to securing broader search and seizure protections in this digital era. Search and seizure in our digital age has become complicated by technological arrangements, as well as by federal case law and governmental practice that have given less protection to personal data held by third-party vendors. And we see that stemming from a series of court cases that began back in the 1970s that have continued up to the present day, where federal courts, when personal data has been vested with third-party vendors, they've given that less and less protection. So you don't need to meet the probable cause standard in many instances to get that. And so that's really the core of what we're trying to address with this this constitutional change. In addition, the practices of federal agencies and the approach they've brought to search and seizure of digital data have informed the practices that we've seen other states adopting, including agencies within this state. Just as the FBI has for many years viewed individual cell phone location data, which is personal data vested with a third-party vendor, as not being protected by Fourth Amendment standards, this was also the case with many Minnesota law enforcement agencies up until last year. They did not view this as being protected by a reasonable expectation of privacy. Now, the legislature addressed this last year. They actually instituted a warrant requirement to get that for law enforcement to get that information. The problem is that this is one statutory change to address one particular instance. And these kind of digital questions about digital data held by third parties are going to continue to come up because more and more people are doing this kind of thing. They're keeping their personal information with third parties. And so a constitutional change that recognizes this practice is really a high-level fix where you don't have to be coming back year after year making statutory changes for various circumstances that come up. Thirdly and finally, I think you should avoid amending the Constitution unless you have no other choice. And I think the complexity of the situation that we're in with federal case law over many decades and practices that we've seen developed by government agencies has created a complex situation that calls for high-level clarity. And I think that's what you're going to get with HF 327 passing and the voters ratifying a constitutional amendment. So I'd be happy to take questions about specifics, as this would apply to individual circumstances. But I would like to support this amendment. I think it's good for the people of this state. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Nelson, would you like to ask your question now or continue to wait?
Mr. Chair, I'll continue to wait.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to think of examples. I know that, I don't know if it's counties or who, but maybe states, you know, periodically comb through bank records looking for deadbeat dads who haven't or aren't paying their paternity support, child support, rather. That would be one instance. I don't know how that might be protected or would they have a right to expect to be protected?
Mr. Ealing.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. That issue gets to a case that was decided that started this third-party doctrine. So there was a case called United States versus Smith, I believe. I could be wrong on that. That made bank records third-party records, and that began this process of developing the third-party doctrine. So if you're going to tighten up individual protections on digital data, anything that's going to adhere to the individual, personal information held by a third party, I think is going to meet that higher standard. It's not going to completely eliminate the ability of administrative subpoenas to be issued for highly regulated businesses. That will continue to be the case. But I think you're going to see a higher standard for individual data, personal data.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Runbeck, I would also add that in those cases, there's probable cause. If someone has not been paying their child support, then there's probable cause to check their records.
Mm-hmm. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one other example that comes to mind. So if I'm a perpetrator, you know, surfing online for vulnerable 14-year-olds to meet up and hook up with whatever, what is the interaction then with law enforcement and posing as, you know, 14-year-olds? How does that work?
If there's probable cause to believe that criminal activity is going on, such as in these cases, law enforcement can develop a case, go to a judge, and get a warrant. So you're still going to be able to pursue those kind of bad actors.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative
Chair.
Representative
Rumbach. It does seem like there would be, but at some point, what comes first? You know, the suspicion of this individual or searching to find individuals who are, you know, up to this? So, but thank you.
Thank you. Would you like a response to
that? Yes, okay, if you have
Mr.
a response,
Ealing.
Mr. Chair.
Law enforcement can certainly investigate and pursue leads. So you could be, you know, law enforcement could be trolling the internet looking for people that are engaging in this kind of suspicious activity. Mm-hmm. Once you start to identify a potential suspect, then that would trigger the warrant process. You'd have to develop probable cause to be able to go get a warrant to search the digital records.
So
it wouldn't prohibit the ability to look for people and develop leads.
Representative Rumbach.
Chair, okay, just to confirm that then, the trolling by law enforcement would be permissible, you think?
If people are in chat rooms, publicly accessible chat rooms, or those sorts of things, that would not be barred. That kind of activity by law enforcement mm-hmm. to look for that activity would not be barred mm-hmm. by this amendment.
I see. Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm still trying to wrap my head around this because, you know, there is concern about third-party data out there. So currently, like Representative Rumbach was mentioning, law enforcement could look through third-party data, and if they find probable cause, they could get a warrant and serve it. What does this amendment change then?
Can you
give me specifics, please?
Certainly. In regard to third-party data, they don't need to meet the warrant standard currently. So that's a reasonable suspicion standard, which is a lower standard. So in many instances, the law enforcement agency can conduct an administrative search on their own. And the only time a court gets involved is if somebody refuses to turn over records, they could have a court enforce their subpoena, their administrative subpoena that they serve. So it's different from the higher standard of a search warrant where you have to develop your facts, go to a judge, and then have the judge sign off ahead of time on the search warrant. So that's the difference in the standard right there, is that there's a judicial check before the search happens as opposed to later on in that process.
Representative Joachim.
So could you give me a specific example of how this would change that then? Just a specific example then, how that would change what's already happening and already needing the search warrant and probable cause.
Sure.
Mr. Ealing.
Let's look at the search of digital cell phone location data. So prior to the legislature acting and implementing a warrant standard last year, law enforcement could essentially on their own activate equipment to be able to pull cell phone signals out of the air and track people's individual location. So they could do that on their own power without having to go to a judge. But because the legislature, I think, rightly decided that this is a reasonable expectation of privacy applies to your individual location data, where your cell phone is activated and where you are by extension, that a warrant was required for that. And so it's those kinds of digital searches, those metadata searches, and we're going to see more and more of this over time, too, because people are increasingly using all kinds of internet-connected devices in their house. You know, you can have apps on your phone that measure the temperature of your house or tell you if there's, you know, your motion detector is being set off. And those are indications of what people are doing in their homes. And that is digital, very telling personal digital information that third parties are holding. So we're saying that if law enforcement wants to get that, it could certainly be relevant to certain criminal investigations. They just need to meet the warrant requirement standard before they get it.
Representative Joachim.
Okay, I'm thinking I'm starting to understand this. So we did the statute last year, and we talked a little bit about this on Tuesday about ceding our legislative power over to another branch, and I know there's always concerns about interpretation by the courts. And from what I understand, constitutional amendments are wide open and broad for interpretation, where statutes were able to draw specific lines in the sand and be very intentional. Mm-hmm. So wouldn't that be a better way to approach this instead of putting a blanket constitutional amendment out there instead of applying statute and law so the courts would know exactly what our intent was?
Mr.
Ealing?
In the course of normal constitutional interpretation, you would absolutely be correct. What this is attempting to do is to roll back decisions that have been made at a federal level and say we disagree with federal courts' decisions to have so much discretion in accessing third-party records. here in Minnesota, we'd like to make that tighter. And so it's really going back and addressing what's happened in the past already.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Joachim. One of the things we're trying to get away from with all the advancements in technology is to have piecemeal legislation, have piecemeal statutes, so that you have to go back to the table every time a new piece of technology has come onto the scene. And so this amendment basically covers whatever comes into the future.
Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I can completely understand that, but putting it in a document that is meant to be fixed versus statutes that are meant to be movable and nimble, I mean, we didn't put horse and buggy in the Constitution because now we have cars. So I know technology is going to keep moving, so I kind of hesitate to put it to a constitutional amendment then. And then I just had one more question. Mr. Ealing, aren't you a member of an organization too? But you said you were here testifying as an individual?
Yes.
Mr. Ealing.
I'm affiliated with the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information, but our organization doesn't take positions on search and seizure issues, just on government data classification. Okay. And so that's why I'm here as an individual today.
Got it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Nelson.
If Mr. Elling will keep near, we can hear the other testifiers and
bring
your questions from everybody and as we go along.
Sounds good. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Morning, sir. Welcome to the committee. If you would, just introduce yourself and who you represent.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Benjamin Feist. I'm the legislative director for the American Civil Liberties Union of Minnesota, the ACLU. Of Minnesota is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting the civil liberties of Minnesotans. So we have come into looking at this amendment, this proposed amendment, from the perspective, as both Representative Scott and Mr. Ealing have brought up, from the point that we really shouldn't be tinkering with the Constitution lightly. And in a lot of instances, we have vigorously opposed attempts to contract liberty. In this case, we're expanding liberty, and that's the reason that the ACLU supports this. I don't have a lot of additional information to add. I think the testimony that we've already heard has covered a lot of our interests in this. I will simply echo a little bit here that we would hope that this type of information would be covered under the Minnesota Constitution as is, but there has been way too much question in the last few years about whether that's the case. And the burden that has been on the legislature to deal with this in a piecemeal manner and try to keep ahead of this technology has consistently fallen behind. And at the same time, the Supreme Court has gotten involved at this, the United States Supreme Court, but it's left more ambiguity than answers, ultimately. So it's our position that this will only help to protect liberty going forward, and we support this amendment going forward.
Thank you, Mr. Feist. With that, Representative Nelson, ready.
Thank you, Mr.
It's
Chair.
All yours.
I wonder if there's anybody that's going to testify against it, but we can find that out afterwards. I guess a couple things, and Representative Joachim brought up some of the questions I have searching in my mind here. And one of them, but one that just brought up when we talked about this is issues before the U.S. Supreme Court, and they've had some rulings. And again, I'm not an attorney, so and I don't try to play one on TV either. So the question I have here, my understanding of the Supreme Court, if they rule that this type of communication, third-party communication, if they rule that that is part of the Fourth Amendment, that it already is covered by that, I guess what is the need then for us to pass this? And I have issues in my mind about putting constitutional amendments on for every new piece of technology that comes forward, every new thing that maybe we don't think is covered or may be covered, where, again, statute, we've done it last year with statute, we can continue to do it with statute. I guess why, this is a seems to me that we're taking a broad axe to something that we could do, or a sledgehammer to something that we could use a finishing hammer to fix by doing legislation. So I guess, why am I wrong in that thinking of that, and why it convinced me that that this is the right way to go?
Who would like to? Representative Scott.
And the other testifiers can chime in, too.
Absolutely.
If they'd like. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, the Supreme Court has really only ruled on the one case that I'm aware of, and that's Riley v. California. Maybe the testifiers know of other cases. But that was exclusively just addressing a smartphone. They didn't really, in their opinion, didn't broaden that out to include any other electronic device. And so what we're doing, as you know, just like with the HIPAA, that's a federal law. State laws can be more specific. And so this is what we're trying to do, is give these protections to people. And I truly believe if you look at the list of things that the founders listed in that, in their persons, homes, papers, and effects. I mean, they were specific enough to put papers. They were specific enough that I think that it merits this addition, because I think that had they had the technology that we do now, I think they would have included that. So that's my stab at your question, but I'll let
Mr. Feist, Mr. Ealing. Mr. Ealing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In addition to clarifying what the Constitution means and trying to retroactively deal with these federal cases that apply a lesser standard to digital third-party records, I think this also gives the state the opportunity to lead the national discussion about this, because I think we can all agree that, for instance, the Federal National Security Agency collecting all of our phone records, I mean literally all of our phone records of who we've called, is unreasonable. And that decision by the NSA was based on the Smith versus Maryland, a third-party doctrine law from, you know, several years back, saying that they could access that stuff, and they've amped it up to now say we can access all of it and acquire all of it, not just individual data that we think is connected to wrongdoing. We can access everything. And so for the state to say, look, we want to try to roll back some of these third-party problems that have happened in federal law, really puts us as a leader in this area and puts really pressure on this federal Supreme Court to revisit these kind of things as they see states address this down the line. And it's happened before. The Supreme Court has been able to go back and look at case law that it's decided on before in light of new facts and new circumstances and change its direction.
Mr. Speaker, follow up.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Or Mr. Chair. Maybe I'll be promoting.
Depending
you
on the day.
Yeah. I guess the that just again brings to my mind that why are we taking this broad approach where, if this my understanding, Supreme Court, if we pass this and it passes the voting public, and the Supreme Court then, in their future, looking at this and looking at other cases, the Supreme Court rules that, no, this is not a violation, wouldn't that overturn our state statute? I mean, they've done that in the past, overturned statutes, and they've overturned constitutional amendments that states have passed saying that this or that, you know, again, so why is it that necessary to do the constitutional amendment and not do the thoughtful process of saying, okay, this is covered, but this isn't, that we can do in state law, do it by passing statute as opposed to a constitutional amendment?
I think, Mr. Ealing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to restate what I mentioned before, I really think that the number of situations that are going to be coming at us is going to be very, very intense. There's going to be a lot of different situations, like the cell phone location situation. The Data Privacy and Data Practices Subcommittee really heard a lot of testimony. I was there for a lot of it. A lot of different kinds of scenarios might be coming at us. And I think if you deal with it at the constitutional level, at a broad high level, you're going to avoid the necessity and the long process of going through individual court interpretation, statutory interpretation. It doesn't eliminate that, but it gives you high-level guidance where you're going to get rid of a lot of that individualized work.
Anyone else at the testifiers table? Just a comment? No? Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'm still not convinced that we need to go the route of a constitutional amendment. I'm still I think we can do, as a legislature, we can do our job and look at these things and even maybe have a broad statute that we pass that covers these things. I think would have just as much power as doing a constitutional amendment. And then if it's something in the future, if something happens that unintended consequences of this constitutional amendment, then we'd have the ability to correct that if it was in statute, as opposed to if we put it in the Constitution, this is a document that's locking us up, and we'd take another constitutional amendment to correct issues that would come forward. So I guess that's kind of the way I'm thinking here. I'm not, like I said, looking at this going forward. We're going to have to deeply look at this, because passing a constitutional amendment, and this is something I believe on everyone that's come forward to us in the past, is something big, and it needs to be something big, because it's, like I said, it's a sledgehammer. Instead of coming at this with the sledgehammer, we should come at it more with the finishing hammer and be more precise in what we do.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Representative Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question. Am I right to assume that the states would be pushing the federal government, pushing the Supreme Court, as opposed to actually being able to supersede federal law? If the NSA still wanted to collect data, they still could, regardless of this constitutional amendment.
Representative Ealing.
That is correct. We cannot supersede federal law, but Fourth Amendment case law coming from the Supreme Court sets the baseline, and the Minnesota Supreme Court frequently looks to that as the baseline for search and seizure law. There's a line of cases within Minnesota law, the Minnesota Supreme Court level, where they've interpreted broader protections. And if we write specific broader protections into Minnesota's constitution, then that gives them the base to grant additional rights at the state level. It wouldn't change how the NSA is able to operate, but it would send a signal to Washington, certainly, that, look, the states are concerned about this. You at the federal level should also look at this, too.
Representative Scott, did you have a comment as well?
I was going to agree with what Matt said, that this doesn't affect what the feds are doing with the NSA and that sort of thing, but it does send the message. And just wanted to add that this passed in Missouri by a 75% margin. And in their legislature, I think in their Senate in particular, I think there are only less than a handful of folks that opposed it. And so bipartisan support in the Missouri legislature. There are some other states, I believe, that are looking at this, doing the same thing this year.
Representative Lane, a follow-up? Thank you. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Ealing, could you help us understand where your concern is with metadata? I understand, you know, my phone and somebody looking at me specifically, but metadata, what's the big deal? I don't quite get it. So if it's just looking at a phone number that connects with a phone number, share with me. I mean, it seems like this doesn't distinguish those two levels.
Mr. Ealing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The amendment would address digital communications and data. So the data portion would adhere, in my view, to this question of digital metadata very specifically. And for me, there is an error made by the Supreme Court. I do not feel that as an individual, who I call, the phone number that I'm calling, or who is calling me, should somehow be accessible by the government at a low legal threshold. I think that's personal information that's an effect of my person. And so that's where the language of the Fourth Amendment, the effects, and their protection by the reasonable protection, reasonable privacy protections, starts to diverge from case law, where those are no longer seen as having individualized suspicion necessary to access them. The government can simply send an administrative subpoena. So that's a real fundamental issue that runs through all metadata, because the metadata is really information about your activities, you know, what's going on with you in your home. For instance, as I alluded to earlier, with digital apps and those sorts of things. So that's what that gets at, if that helps to clarify.
Well, Representative Runbeck.
Mr. Chair, I mean, it just seems like there's a vast difference in my mind still. For the most part, metadata is pretty anonymous until there's such information built up that there's something going on, let's just say. And I personally wouldn't want to preclude that. And doesn't FISA have warrant requirements at some point where they must get those and obtain those?
FISA has warrant requirements for certain things, but in regards to the Section 215 acquisition of telephone metadata, there is no warrant. There's a provision of the Patriot Act that basically says you have to show that it's reasonable that the acquisition of the records are relevant to an ongoing terrorism investigation. And relevance has been interpreted by the NSA to mean everything is relevant. I mean, that's literally what's in the legal opinions they're looking at. And that's the danger, really, of sort of the unlimited access to metadata, is that it's particularly if the government at the federal level is making these kind of decisions that we can access everything, then you're going to start to see very, very individualized patterns of behavior of all of us. And I just don't think that they should have access to that unless they have individual, articulable suspicion that I have committed a crime. Absolutely, they should be able to go after that, but not until that point.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Representative Brumbeck.
I'm not convinced about that piece of it.
Representative Joaquin.
A few quick questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned a third-party doctrine, and I'm going to completely show my ignorance here and ask what that is.
Mr. Ealing or Mr. Feist? Mr. Ealing.
Sure. The third-party doctrine came out of two cases under federal law that reached back to the 1970s. One is called Smith versus Maryland that held that the telephone numbers that you're calling and the telephone numbers coming into you are not protected by a reasonable expectation of privacy, and so law enforcement could just get those under a very low legal threshold. And the other is the Miller case. It was in the United States versus Miller, the bank records case that I referred to earlier, where information that you lodge with your bank about your personal finances is not protected by a reasonable expectation of privacy. For me, both of those set a really bad precedent because that's very personal, sensitive information. And the federal courts have built upon that, and federal agencies have built upon that to do things like the mass metadata collection program the NSA does, the collection of cell phone location data. And so you see the in those cases the building blocks for everything that subsequently happened. And that's why we want to say, look, in Minnesota, we don't want to go in that direction. So let's deal with this at a high level in the Constitution.
Representative Joaquin.
That makes a little bit more sense. I was just wondering what it was because it kept being referenced to. One question I had, and I was trying to wrap my brain around this bill, so I listened to the civil law hearing, and what was brought up by Representative Schoen kind of went along that line of unreasonable and reasonable for searches. And are there some unintended consequences that would hurt public safety by having such a broad blanket put across data? I mean, Representative Schoen brought one up when it was coming to being able to ping a cell phone if a child was lost, and what more they would have to go through when a sense of urgency might be there.
Thank you,
Mr. Ealing.
As Representative Scott has mentioned, there is exigent circumstances case law that already exists for digital records. So if you look at the Title III federal wiretap law that's mirrored in our Section 626A of Minnesota law, there are emergency circumstances or emergency procedures set out in there, and there's case law behind those emergency circumstances. So the case law recognizes imminent terrorist attack, missing person. Those are two of the main cases that would trigger this emergency exception. So that exception applies to the high legal standards. That says you don't have to get, you can go and do the search without getting a warrant, but you have to retroactively go to a judge and say, look, we had an emergency come up, here's the facts, please issue a warrant, you know, based on these facts, but we had to act fast in the interim. So that case law line would not change, in my opinion, from adding other stuff, other specific items to the list of protected items that are protected by a reasonable expectation of privacy.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ealing, I can understand that if you're a lawyer that you would be looking at it that way, but I'm thinking about some person at Verizon that's supposed to give the data to the police officer who then is worried about doing that and breaking the law and ends up trying to find an in-house lawyer and go through more hoops, and that's what Representative Schoen brought up, that, you know, sometimes in practicality that it doesn't work that way. And while in concept this sounds good, how does it work in practicality in the reasonable world? And I guess that's where I'm having a little trouble and kind of thinking kind of the metadata issue too that Representative Runbeck's brought up.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Joaquin. I really see that argument as a red herring. These companies, cell phone companies and those things, they already know that under exigent circumstances they are to provide that information, and this is not going to change that. And they have lawyers on their staff as well, and would know that that is not at all what this amendment would do.
The line, Mr. Ealing, the case law, and the statute behind the exigent circumstances and the emergency procedures goes back a ways. I mean, the Title III wiretap at the federal level was instituted in 1968, and then right after that, you started getting exigent circumstances case law about searching telephone, you know, intercepting telephone transmissions. And so it's old case law, and it would still apply to this kind of circumstance. And the phone companies deal with these on a regular basis.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can understand that, and I still tend to trust the people that are working day-to-day in the field more than I would trust someone that's once removed, like a lawyer working for a company. So, I mean, those concerns, it may sound like a red herring, but to me they are true concerns of people that are working on the front lines every day worrying about our safety. So, just a question.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm reading here this handout that Representative Scott handed out, and she referenced from Mr. Gearing. And as I read the last paragraph, how do you interpret second last paragraph, but the last paragraph, the way I read that is that in the opinion of Mr. Gearing that this is not necessary. And I guess maybe the question to be to Mr. Gearing, seeing as how he's sitting there, the way I read that is that he's saying that, no, that our current constitution, the state of Minnesota, covers this. And so I guess that's my question. And again, I would then a response from Representative Scott.
Mr. Gearing, are you prepared to shed some light on that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, so in the Civil Law Committee, the question came up about whether the constitutional protections that we currently have apply both to criminal investigative issues and warrants and also to administrative subpoenas, which are issued by state agencies. And so what I looked into was whether the existing constitutional language extends to those administrative subpoenas, and that's what the case law suggests, is that the existing Fourth Amendment protections against unreasonable search and seizure do extend to not just criminal matters but civil matters when a state agency is going in and asking for records or asking for documents from an individual pursuant to an administrative search. And so what this email is just suggesting is that the protections that are in the bill and that are proposed in the bill would extend to potential administrative subpoenas related to electronic data as well. So it's not the email is not suggesting that the one way or the other about whether this is an appropriate policy to add to the Constitution.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Gere.
Yeah. Representative Joaquin.
So going back to Representative Runbeck's question about like a county or an HHS or somebody looking back at records to see who's been paying child support, currently they could use an administrative subpoena, but now under this new law they would have to give a search warrant, which is a higher level.
Who would like that? Mr. Gearing, why don't you start if you can?
Mr. Sharon, Representative Joaquin, this... as I understand the language, this wouldn't change the process for issuing an administrative subpoena or require any different procedure for those agencies. All this does is require that if an administrative subpoena is issued, then it under current law and under the proposed language, the administrative subpoena must still be reasonable based on case law designating when a subpoena is reasonable or not. And so if the subpoena is extending to a search of electronic data or bank records or something, then it will be the case that the subpoena must be issued consistent with case law that designates what constitutes a reasonable subpoena.
So if case
Representative Joaquin.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. So if case law already does that, why would we put it in the Constitution? I'm still stumbling on the broader approach.
Mr. Ealing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me try to draw this distinction. So an administrative subpoena is served without probable cause by a government agency. They're serving that on an organization, you know, a business that is a third-party provider of, say, you know, email or some electronic, computing service. You as an individual have given over certain personal data to that business. Now, the administrative subpoena still needs to be reasonable under the Fourth Amendment, but the business is the only person or the only entity that can challenge whether it's reasonable. Because you as an individual generally are not going to know if this subpoena has been issued. And in some cases, protective orders are issued, so you can't find out. So the business, they have to make the determination, are they going to fight it or not? And they're not going to make that determination based on your behalf. You know, they're going to take their own interest into it as a business organization, you know, because they've got to invest a lot of time and effort into fighting in court in the issuance of administrative subpoenas. So that's why if you institute the probable cause standard, then it's applying to individual data that's held by that third-party vendor, and that's why it's going to be distinct, because then the judge has to make a determination about, are they going to allow your individual data to be accessed? And the business really is kind of taken out of the equation of having to contest the reasonableness of that search. Does that make sense?
And if I hold on one second here, I just want to let Representative Scott answer. But for me too, I think we're here. Maybe I can help simplify this a little bit in my understanding. Right. So taking a little bit of a chair prerogative here. So Article 1, Section 10, we're talking about the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects. So the process is not in question. What we're doing here is adding another category on equal footing and saying that electronic communications and data. So the same process used if we need a warrant or we're looking at a reasonable search or seizure, that same process that law enforcement or the courts would use in that determination for a person, their house, their papers, their effects would also now be applied to just electronic communications and data. So the process isn't changing. We're adding a new category to that, which is a clarification. I would argue that even effects, I would hope electronic communications would be there, but I think as we've heard from the testifiers and from court proceedings that we haven't seen that. So I think we're clarifying that. We're adding electronic communications and data in there. We're not changing the process. We're not changing anything else, but just adding that in. And so I think we're getting down in the weeds on the process and that sort of stuff, and I don't think, in my understanding, that any of that would change. Representative Scott, and we'll go back to Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that clarification. It's easy to get off on some of these tangents. Well, what if this happens and that happens? And Representative Hillstrom was thinking outside of what you just said. As a prosecutor, she is concerned that legal processes don't change so that the court's hands are not tied or the prosecutor's office in this case are not tied. And what Representative Sanders just explained is the process is not changing. We are just broadening what protections we have, what personal protections we have.
Representative Joaquin.
I thank you for the clarification. That was kind of how I was understanding it, too. And I guess mine goes back to worrying about putting another classification in the Constitution, which is the document that's set that can't be adjusted if we're seeing an unintended consequence, kind of like, it's going to sound like a stupid analogy, but you start fixing up an old house and you tear down a wall and all of a sudden you see all this other stuff behind it. You're able to adjust to that. I feel like our statutes are like that too, but the Constitution is really solid. So I worry about unintended consequences of adding a whole entire category that may or may not be covered under effects, depending on what case law you look at. So and just some concerns on more of the practicality. Like I said, the concept is great, but how does it going to work in the real world? And that's where I rely on the people that work in that real world that are dealing with every other situation every day that I'm not. So that's what I'm just trying to understand.
Thank you, Representative Joaquin. Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to thank Representative Scott for bringing this bill. It's just very, very important. And I also like to thank the testifiers, Mr. Feist and Mr. Elling, for your just expert testimony to really help clarify this, you know, what can be a very, very confusing issue and a concern. I have received a tremendous amount of feedback already from my constituents requesting my support for this, and I do. I think that you've all spoken just very eloquently about the broad nature of this and wanting to ensure that we're covering this at the highest level. I mean, to Mr. Elling's point about the number of situations that will be coming at us that we can't even imagine right now and the velocity of the change, it's really incomprehensible. And I'm just so grateful that you've brought this bill in the form of a constitutional amendment, Representative Scott. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Pugh. At this time, we don't have any other member questions. Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify for or against this House file? Seeing none, Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, I just have a process question here. This is going to state government finance from here. What is the route this is going to take after here, I guess, is the question. Is there... other committees that's going to go to, do we know?
Thank you, Representative Nelson. We'll certainly let the bill author speak to that. It's my understanding that after state government finance, it could go to public safety. That will be up to the chairs, but is my understanding that that would be next on the path. But Representative Scott, I don't know if you have any other information.
I will be having a conversation with Representative Cornish to see if he wants to see it or not.
Representative Joaquim.
Thank you. Representative Nelson took the question out of my mouth. I know, and when I was listening to the civil law hearing, you had mentioned that you were going to have that conversation with Representative Cornish. So is my understanding you haven't yet, or?
Representative Scott?
Mr. Chair, no, I have not yet.
Okay. Did Representative Cornish ask to hear it yet? I mean, search and seizure is criminal as well as civil, so it should go there, but.
Representative Scott?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Joaquim, no, he has not mentioned it to me.
Thank you.
And we still have some time in the process. It absolutely is going to state government finance, so we still have some time. Any final member questions or comments? Seeing none, Representative Scott, we'll give you the last word.
I would just encourage your support. I think we've had a pretty good debate.
Thank you, Representative Scott. Thank you, Mr. Ealing. Thank you, Mr. Feist. Excellent, thoughtful comments. Thank you, members, for a good discussion. Seeing no further discussion, Representative Scott renews her motion that House File 327 be referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The House File is passed and is on its way to State Government Finance. Thank you all very much. With that, members, we are adjourned.